Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, January the 30th, 2025, and this is episode 3619 of the Survival Podcast. It is a Thursday, and it is time for an expert counsel Q&A show. And, well, the last news show of January. There is one more day in January. It will be a Friday flashback rewind-type show, though. So this will be our last show in January. You know what I'm going to say if you're a long-term listener. You know, tick-tock. The clock ticks for us all. We are not on a sliding scale in life. There's only one reality here, and that is you are either moving toward more self-sufficiency, self-reliance, independence, and liberty, or life is moving you backward. You cannot be static in this. It's not a sliding scale. You've got to take action. I've been putting some impetus under you lately. Spring is coming. Spring is going to spring faster than you think. If you're going to garden, you need to be putting those beds in, you getting those birds ready, getting the brooder ready, starting the plants, whatever it is. All those winter projects, including one we're going to talk about today, is a good one to get done while it's cold outside, because it gets done on the inside. That's from Nicole Sauce. We'll get to that in a minute. What do we have today? Well, we've got a bunch of stuff. First of all, since Trump took office in 2 weeks, the crossings at the border are down 93%. Yoo-hoo, wave, yeah, whatever. What? But the question and answer on it that Chris Rossini and Dan McAdams from the Ron Paul Liberty highlights this week have for you is, what does that say about Biden and Harris? All their claims that they couldn't fix the problem because of the bipartisan bill that Trump killed, and Trump just walks in, signs a couple of pieces of paper, and he gets it done. Okay. Then I got Andy McCann talking about keeping your mobility and flexibility as you age. He has a document for you as well on that, and I'm going to add to everything he says about stretching and going weight loss. If you are overweight for your frame, I don't even say obese, if you are significantly overweight, you are going to have flexibility and mobility issues. If you are underweight and under-muscled, you will also have those. So those are my adds to that one. Doc Ken Berry will be talking to us about low blood pressure on keto and carnivore. And this, I think what Ken's going to say applies to people who maybe aren't keto and carnivore as well. Like, your doctor says your blood pressure's low, but is it? Sometimes, you know, they say it's high, but is it? Okay. Doc Bones, so we're back-to-back doctors today. What is tularemia? And what do you need to know about it? I'll give you the common name for rabbit fever. And Doc will talk about that. Now we got Kerry Brown talking about sassafras. Now is the time for harvest and planting as well, right? It's a good time to be looking at that very famous tree/herb in American history, honestly. Nicole Sauce will tell you why winter's a great time to do what? Audit your pantry. I have a little kicker on this one. There's something that we do about this time of year as well. Unfortunately, it doesn't keep you nice and warm inside like a pantry does. It involves the garage and another place you keep food for us. But it's pretty warm in the garage itself. But it ain't warm in where? Those deep freezers. It's a good time to do a freezer audit as well, especially if you have a chest freezer where things tend to just disappear. Then we have a really great segment on direct solar water pumping from Ryan Steva. And I'm going to have some additions on this one. I'm going to have a backup or a hack for an issue that he'll bring up. A really simple, he gives a solution to it that's a little more complicated than the one I'm going to give you. I'm going to give you a dead simple solution to part of that. And we'll talk about some other uses for his stuff, some stuff I'm going to implement, because I didn't realize I could do it this cheap. And then he's got a whole laundry list of products that are linked in today's show notes. Then I'm going to do a follow-up from last week. Last week, I basically said, don't spend your Bitcoin. That's stupid. I also think that it was maybe misunderstood. There were some comments made by some angry Maxis, which I expected. But they were also saying I said something I didn't say, that if you spent any of your Bitcoin, you were stupid. I didn't. What I said is all these people telling you it's important for you to spend your Bitcoin is no different than somebody telling you it's important for you to spend your money. And these people need to shut up, and they're stupid. There is a big difference between you being stupid for you deciding what you're going to do with the thing that's yours and someone else telling you what you need to do with the thing that's yours. I thought I was clear, so I'll expand on that. And I also did listen to my own segment, and I realized how it could be misconstrued. So I want to clear some things up. And I want to also let you know about a great video that just dropped this week from Mark Moss on the executive order about crypto and how that applies to Bitcoin and some things that are coming, which makes it even more important for you to DC every day, stack all the way, never stop. And as I dare say it, don't spend your Bitcoin unless you know why you're spending your Bitcoin. Don't do it just to do it. That was my whole point. And some of the things that are coming are going to make people that spent their Bitcoin wish they didn't spend their freaking Bitcoin. I'm just telling you that. All right. With that, let's go ahead and dive on into it. But what I want to start out with today is our item of the day. So like I've been saying, we have spring bearing down on us like a bullet. And if you are planning on putting in new garden beds this year, I really encourage you right now to look at the galvanized raised garden beds from Vivor. They are fantastic. You cannot build a raised bed with lumber for the cost of these things. You can't do it as quick and fast and easy. And as I keep saying, I really recommend, you know, they come 2 foot deep. They also come 1 foot deep. It's like 11 foot, 8 inches or something. That's the one most of y'all really need to be looking at. I go with a deeper bed because of how shallow my soils are and because I have these things called ducks that like to get into stuff. So by going 2 foot deep with my beds, you know, that works better for me. For most people, 6 inches is high enough for a raised bed. So 1 foot definitely is. You'll find your fill for your raised beds ends up sometimes costing more than the beds themselves. So by having less fill, you have less to sweat. I'll also tell you this about your raised beds. Let's say you have pretty decent soil, but you want raised beds for whatever reason. If you fill that bed halfway, 50, 60% your first season, there's nothing wrong with that. And you can keep adding to and building up over time. Don't feel compelled to go all the way to the surface. In some ways, there can be some advantages. How does that work? Okay. So we take a 12-inch deep. Give a little bonus content today in addition to the item of the day. Take a 12-inch raised bed, put 6 inches of dirt in it. Now you've got 6 inches before you get up out of it. It's only 4 foot wide. Plant it so that the long dimension is against your prevailing spring wind. Do you see where I'm going here? Now when you stick that little pepper plant or that little tomato plant in there, it's got a wind break until it gets 7 inches tall, and then only the top of it's in the wind. By then, it's got itself established, it's gotten a little bit more robust, a little more honey badger attitude going on, and it's better able to handle that. Because I'm telling you around here, we can plant in March, but then what you end up doing is you look at your little plants, just they look like a miniature, like your pepper plant, or you could be like a tree in a typhoon, like in a miniature like scene or something. It's just really wicked wind. So that's a way you can take what you think is a detriment and turn it into an advantage. And I'm not saying you should do that. I'm saying that's a reason you might do that. And all I'm ever trying to do in this show is get y'all to think for yourselves so that you make your own decisions, including when they're opposite of what I've said. I've always said it's really important to do what you think is right, to believe what you think is right, but to know why you're doing it and why you're believing it. Have the ability to defend the idea for your own benefit. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and hear from Chris Rossini and Dan McAdams over at the Ron Paul Liberty Highlights about border crossings being down 93% in just a couple weeks.
Since Trump has become president, border crossings have gone down 93%, which is a stunning number, stunning percentage. And I have to give him much credit. But, you know, the first thing that came to mind is that this tells us more about the Biden administration than anything else. They had 4 years to do this, and you can't help but think it was purposeful that they did not. So they purposefully, based on the evidence, left the borders open and created so much of a mess that ushered in the new Trump administration. So, and ironically, Harris was the border czar. So we dodged a very big bullet by having her not in for another 4 years and another 4 years with an open border. So in this subject, we have to give the Trump administration much credit in at least, dropping the percentage of border crossings by 93%. Daniel?
Yeah, at some point you have to wonder how much this was a Democrat votes project. You know, bring them in, give them lots of free stuff. Here's a debit card. Go buy whatever you want. And by the way, here's how you vote. You know, and I think that had a lot to do with it. You know, I think I don't want to speak for you, Chris, but I don't think either of us are against immigration. Immigration is U.S. has a long history of immigration, but what we've seen over the past 4 years, especially, is a very, very different animal. It's something very, very different. And so I think it's very dramatic. But I think like a lot of things in this early Trump administration, there is a lot to cheer for. There's like this initial Shazam, you know, this initial gestalt. They have dealt with an issue that have been languishing, and there's so many of them. And I have a couple to talk about later that have been languishing. You know, this is was a zombified administration that did nothing about them. And now, boom, they hit some of the real problems. But in the longer term, as our mentor, Dr. Paul, always says, you have to get to the heart of the issue. And people come here illegally because of perverse incentives to come here illegally. It's harder to come here legally. That's why, interestingly enough, the people who are at the most opposed to illegal immigration from Mexico are people from Mexico who came here legally. So we have to address the underlying issue in addition to this immediate issue. Yes. I think most people will agree that sending back criminals who come over here illegally and commit crimes, send them somewhere else, that's fine. Put them on an island somewhere. Who cares? But nevertheless, you've got to do something about the perverse incentives for people to come here illegally. And you have to have a clear path for people who want to come here legally. Don't let other people cut in line. So, yeah, cautiously very optimistic, very dramatic result, Chris.
Yeah, I agree. And we do hear about the deportations every day. The Trump administration is advertising it, as would be expected. The numbers, I think it was 1,000 or 1,200 something yesterday. When you take these numbers, when you consider that 10 million people came in, the job ahead is it's beyond massive. So even if they were to do 1,000 a day over a year, it's 300,000 compared to 10 million. That's barely a dent. We'll see what happens. But as far as border crossings, we'll take this as a W.
Sadly, I think the takeaway from it, they got exactly right, but I'll expand it. And that is that the Biden-Harris administration wasn't the Biden-Harris administration anyway. It was the deep state administration. They put in a complete idiot, and they put in a guy who, even if he wasn't an idiot, had turned into an idiot due to the ravages of aging on his mind. They put in two people with absolutely no control over anything, and they did whatever they wanted for 4 years. And the vast majority of what they did weakened America and sent us on a course toward oblivion, which I can only come to the conclusion that that means it's exactly what their goal was. In the words of Stafford Beer, the purpose of the system is what it does, and arguing as to what it claims to do is pointless. I think they wanted everything that happened to happen, and they wanted it to go for another at least 4 years, figuring that by the end of that additional 4 years, they would have broken the will of the American people and done so much damage there was no way out of it, and they might have been able to maintain control for decades after that. Yeah, I believe all that, because there's nothing that counters that logic. Not argument, counters that logic. There is nothing you can show me that was done in the last 4 years that legitimately put America on a better footing for anything at all. We weakened ourselves in every freaking way. We attached ourselves like a deranged leech to a losing war in Ukraine. We've pumped money into Ukraine that could have fixed many problems in America, and all it did was get almost a million Ukrainian men either killed or injured to the point where their lives are altered forever. The Ukrainians are now drafting 18-year-olds against their will, grabbing them off the street and throwing them in vans. Ukrainians are now walking across and surrendering to Russia en masse. Not everywhere, but here and there, large numbers, just basically going, we quit. And Russia's like, come on over. Come on over. We won't shoot you if you do that. This whole thing's gone into a tailspin. And all it's done is suck the lifeblood out of America and our supposed ally. And I could go on with 100 different things like that. The DEI bullshit inside of our own government, incentivizing companies to do DEI, letting people run rampant with complete stupidity. If you disagree with my assessment that the entire purpose was to weaken America and weaken America's people and weaken America's position in the world, give me one thing that improved our position in the world over the last 4 years. Just one. I'd love to hear from you. Next up, let's talk about something different and a little bit more productive for you. As we get older, we start to lose flexibility, mobility, etc. Andy McCann will tell us what to do about it.
Hello and good morning, guys. This is Andy McCann here with your health and fitness opportunities and solutions. I got a couple things for you for free that I'm going to tell you about at the end. But I was emailing back and forth with Sean Mills, and I'm going to take his question, and I'm going to expand on it and give you an answer. So basically he is saying, hey, and again, I'm expanding this. So no, I know, Sean, you didn't actually say all this. But hey, I am getting older, and I'm relatively active. I'm on my homestead doing things, yet I find that I can't put on my shoes correctly. Yet I find that I have to, like, contort myself to get pants on because I just can't bend low enough. Yet I find, insert the thing where you have to squirm and do, like, twister to get into or around or whatever, and it usually has to do with me touching my feet or something, okay? So the problem is I'm losing flexibility, and why? And what can I do about it? So the unfortunate answer is your body is super adaptable. It will become what you want it to. This is the weird thing. People can eat vegan. I know you're going to die. People can eat carnivore. You guys are going to live forever. But your body will adjust and make it work for a while. I've been doing this strict carnivore or very light lion diet with Evan to fight off Crohn's. And I've just been doing it to support him. And this is 6 months for me. He has fixed his stomach. I'll do a whole podcast on that later on. But he is beating Crohn's via the lion diet and hiring a mentor. Guys, hire people like Jack. Hire people out there like Jesse. If you need to do something, get a mentor. Anyway, what can you do about losing this flexibility? A lot. Your body wants to become whatever it is that you're asking it to be. So if you are just walking, then your body is going to shorten all of the tendons to be the most efficient thing it can at walking, because that's all you gave it. You have to push back against the edges of comfortability to gain that sort of stuff. So one thing that I would recommend is always, you know, use a door jam and go into a deep squat. That's the easy one. Just do that a couple times a day. That's going to help a lot. Now, Sean solved it by, hey, I think I'm going to join Pilates. I'm like, dude, yeah, that's probably one of the best things you could do. Hire a mentor and then get in a class and go do this. Now, maybe his wife and daughter are doing it as well. I don't know. I always find it easier to do in a group. But anyway, so again, expanding on his question a lot more than he really was asking is, hey, I'm getting older and my ability to move is getting less. I'm becoming less mobile. Yes, when you turn 62, if you trip and fall, which most people do, they're going to be 33% more likely die that year. So we want to be mobile. We want to turn that trip into a sexy dance. So what can you do? This is stuff, man. It's consistency and the ritual is going to help. So if you have a morning ritual, do some of these things. You might have to Google some of this because I can't show you, but for about 5 to 10 minutes, do this. So there's some yoga stretches, the cat-cow stretch, to loosen up your hips. You can do the world's greatest stretch, which is going to focus on your hip flexors, your hamstrings, and your spine. You could also hold a deep squat. Now, this is a problem. Most of us can't do that. So use a door jam. So the deep squat would be your hip crease is below the top of your knees. You're still on your heels. Hold that for about 30 seconds. This doesn't take much time, but you need to do it. So it's a great morning routine. Now, I would say if you're super sweaty, then do this because you're already warm, but that's okay. Another one is doing some targeted flexibility work. All right, so you've got a couch stretch. So basically, kneel down, put your top of your foot, like the laces, on the couch, and then lean back. So one foot is out like you're in a deep lunge, but the other foot is up. Yes, this is painful. It hurts. Most of us aren't going to be able to stand up straight nor lean back, but it's a great one. You got a figure four stretch. So Google that one. You're going to have to see these things. So basically, if you're standing on your left leg, you're going to pick your right foot up, put it over your knee, so now you're in a figure four, and then you're going to squat down slowly. Then you got a lying hamstring stretch. So you're on your back, you take a towel or something, put it around 1 foot, and then you pull your foot towards you. So basically one leg is going up in the air and you're pulling it towards you and you just hold that. The other way to do it is to sit with your legs out straight and lean over it. It kind of does the same thing, but you're doing two legs instead of one. Both of them are good. Okay, so this one's going to be hit or miss. Strengthen your weak points. If you're out doing things a lot, you probably don't have many weak points, as in like literally weak. It's probably, again, that flexibility and elongating a tendon. It usually takes, I think they say, 2 minutes of a stretch to elongate. So if you're really only doing it for 30 seconds, you need to do longer, but again, build into it slowly. So strengthen your weak points, what you could do there. So you could do a glute bridge, which is going to obviously strengthen your butt. So basically, Google that, look it up. It's not that tough to do. Do a couple of them, glute bridge raises. You can do step-ups or box step-ups. So again, it's just building that leg strength. So here's the thing I would do on this one. Typically, I tell people, don't overstep. Don't reach so high. But in this case, we're going for flexibility as well as strength. So I would overdo it. So I would pick something that is tough to step onto, like as at the height of where your leg will actually bend. And maybe you got to grab something to help you get up because it's so tall and you just can't do it by yourself. That's okay. What we're doing is increasing that range of motion. Stepping down, be super careful. The next one is lay on your side and then raise your leg up. Again, a strength thing. You may not need this. I would focus on the first two because you're going to get more flexibility out of that. But maybe there's a strength component too. And here's another one that it's not as obvious, but it should be in retrospect. So get on the floor more. So like sit down and then stand up. And if you're like, damn, I have a hard time getting off the ground, do it more. If you do it more, your adaptive body will adapt to that and give you what you need. Your body wants to be the most efficient thing it can be. This is why, like, Jack's whole entire carnivore journey, that thing is awesome. If y'all haven't listened to this, go back in time, go to the YouTube and get his carnivore playlist. Man, it is awesome. And listen, if you need that, right, if you want to fuel yourself better, your body's going to be efficient with that fuel. So give yourself the best fuel it can do. It's going to be efficient. Give yourself the best movements it can get. It's going to be efficient with that. Unfortunately, if you give it crap and you retard your movements, then it's going to be efficient with that too. So watch out. Time is on your side if you do it daily and consistent. If you don't, time is against you. Time wants to fight you. Time is a friend of feebleness. It is chasing you down. Hey guys, this is Andy McCann. You can find me on YouTube at AndyMcCann42, or my podcast is Fitness, Food, and Finances. Y'all take care.
Yeah, like I said, I'll add into everything with that is your weight. Do all the stretching you want and all. You know, if you are significantly overweight for your frame as you age, you're going to have more joint problems. You're going to have more back problems, etc. And the analogy I'm about to give you has to be tempered with, like, biology, right? Because a truck doesn't rebuild itself. You have to actually pull the part out and replace it. But I want you to think about it this way. Two people buy an F-150 pickup truck. One drives, and they're the same. They're equipped exactly the same. One drives that truck around all the time as a daily driver to work and back, puts about 150 miles a day on it, and they carry no weight other than themselves. The other one uses their truck. They take good care of it. They maintain it the same way. They drive about the same mileage, and they don't abuse the truck at all, but on a daily basis, they're hauling, you know, the weight limit of that vehicle or a little bit over it. So, you know, they're running around with 1,200, 1,500 pounds of weight in and out of the vehicle all day long for the same amount of mileage. Which one of those trucks is going to have problems in its suspension system first? Do you have to be an absolute genius to figure this out, or do you think when I asked this exact same question to my 14-year-old grandson this morning, he instantly knew it would be the one bearing the way? All right, now this is the temperance against it. The truck cannot rebuild its suspension. It can't re-strengthen its leaf springs. It doesn't have biology going on that repairs itself. A human being does. But the speed and rapidity in which we can rebuild our burnt-up body parts over time and replenish things like cartilage and strengthen our muscles and deal with it, it goes down over time. So a lot of times you can get away with a lot of this being a little bit overweight without having joint problems and all. You know, when you're 30, 40 years old, but when you're 50, 60, 70, it catches up with you and it catches up with you fast and hard. That's why. So it's really important that we manage not just our activity level, but our weight level. And there's a lot of people say, well, I'm not that overweight, but are you maybe still significantly overweight? You're not obese. but you're 20 pounds maybe, let's say, for a taller male, 20 pounds heavier than you should be, and it ain't muscle, right? My grandpa used to say, I'm all muscle, and he has a big old beer belly, like, Pop, that ain't muscle, you know? He said, Yingling reps. I'm like, no, man, like, that doesn't work. And I'm a person, you know, like Andy said, you can watch my low-carb journey playlist and see me go from low-carb to, you know, keto. I never went carnivore on it, but I went to keto. And you can watch me over about 2 months. You can see my face, and you can see it change over just a very short period of time by changing my diet. And it works. And so when I push that way of living and eating, I push it because it works. I don't care how you do it, as long as you're getting a good full nutritional profile out of your meal. But, you know, I'm not even saying you got to get to your ideal weight, because I think a lot of times ideal weight is bullshit. My ideal weight, according to the federal government of the United States, is 168 pounds. And I'm going to tell you right now, with my frame, if you were just to look at, you know, measure my shoulder width, which there's no fat contributing to my shoulder width at all. For me to weigh 168 pounds, I would look like somebody locked me up in an internment camp or something, or I had cancer and I was undergoing chemo. Like, I was not 168 pounds when I was 2 inches shorter and a senior in high school training every day. So it's not about what the government says so much as what is a good weight for you and figuring out what that is. And if you're constantly aching in your joints and your back and all, there's not something else that is somewhat deteriorative, like an arthritis or something going on, it probably would benefit you a great deal to adjust your weight to your frame size. And so anyway, you can do what you want with that. Now let's hear from Doc Ken Berry. We're going to talk about blood pressure.
Hello, Jack, and all you survivalists. This is Dr. Ken Berry answering a question today from Sean. Sean says, I recently started moving more to a carnivore diet to get my blood pressure in check. My blood pressure is trending to a healthy level. However, my wife's is trending to the low blood pressure level. 100 over 54 was her most recent blood pressure. Any advice on how she can get her blood pressure to rise to a more healthy level and still follow a proper human diet? Appreciate your help. Sean from Maine. So, Sean, here's the key question. I needed some extra information from you that I didn't get. What did your wife feel like when her blood pressure was 100 over 54? The reason I ask this is because for many, many people, a blood pressure of 100 over 54 is completely normal and healthy. Did she have symptoms of low blood pressure? Was she short of breath, lightheaded, sweaty, nauseated? Did she feel like she was dizzy or going to pass out? These are symptoms of low blood pressure. If your answer is no, she felt normal, then this is a completely healthy and normal blood pressure. And this is very important for people to understand that when you start and stick to a proper human diet, you may see blood pressure levels you've never seen in your life. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're too low. It doesn't mean that you have hypotension. Now, if Sean's wife is still taking any blood pressure medicine, this is definitely evidence that it's time to either decrease the dosage or stop it altogether. But if she was not on any blood pressure medicine and she felt perfectly normal when she had a 100 over 54, then this is no cause for concern. Hope this answer helps you, Sean, and everybody else who might have had this question. This is Dr. Berry. Talk to you guys soon.
So I'll just say that blood pressure is something that, and Ken's talked about this before, for you even know what your blood pressure is. Sounds like these people do, but I'm talking more general here. You need to be taking your own blood pressure several times a day when you're evaluating it. I'll tell you straight up, I do not like medical offices. If my blood pressure is taken in a clinical setting, it's going to be 15 to 20 points higher than normal. And I've taken it enough times here at home with a good blood pressure cuff to know that that's the truth. And doctors don't like to listen to that. They don't believe that. They don't understand that. So if the doctors that I've seen, which is pretty few and far between over the years, had their way, I'd be on blood pressure medication. I'll also tell you that my blood pressure at home is in the neighborhood of 5 to 10 points above normal. I'm not medicating that because it also has times where it's a little bit low for normal. It fluctuates throughout the day. And so taking a drug that has adverse reaction consequences for something that's so minor is not something I'll do, but boy, would every doctor that ever sees me like to put me on it, even if they accept, which is hard to get them to do, my numbers, because I've literally put it in a book and said, here it is. So this is one of those things you have to be actively involved in. Now, that number, I'm not a doctor, and Ken is, seems a little bit low, but I've seen my wife's blood pressure like that plenty of times. And so I think it is important to look at, are there other, you know, and keep an eye on it. Like, if it trends much lower than, you know, when I say much, I mean even, you know, any significant amount lower than that, that's something to start really worrying about. But to me, that's probably not the problem that people think it is. Now, I've seen people with low blood pressure have these symptoms, and I'll tell you a lot of times what it is. They're dehydrated. So the one thing I would add to what Ken said is make sure that she's getting enough water every day. And women tend to be worse about this than men, because when you drink a lot of water, you got to pee a lot. And if you're going toward carnivore keto, you have to pee a lot anyway. And then the other side of that is, did she just start this new way of living along with you? Because when you do that, you do get a huge flush of fluids from your body. So salt and water probably need to be added to this equation. Next up, let's hear about rabbit fever from old Doc Bones.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net. Co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Officials from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, report that cases of tularemia, an uncommon disease found in rabbits and rodents, have increased by nearly 60% in the U.S. in the last 10 years. Caused by the bacterium Francisella tularensis, it was first discovered in Tularay County in California in the year 1911. Since then, tularemia has been found in every state except Hawaii. Cases are most common in the central United States, the Pacific Northwest, and parts of the East Coast, so pretty widespread. There are four subspecies of Francisella, differing in where they can be found and their ability to cause severe disease. Francisella tularensis type A is the most dangerous type, only found in Northern America. Luckily, tularemia is still relatively rare, with about 2,500 cases recorded in the U.S. between 2011 and 2022, mostly in warm weather months. Despite this, the family medic must always know about all sorts of infectious diseases that they might encounter off the grid in times of trouble. This is one of them. Now, how does tularemia spread? Tularemia is often seen in rabbits, where it is known as rabbit fever, and it can cause mass die-offs in native populations. Infection is a known zoonotic disease, which means that it can spread from animals to humans. How does tularemia end up in human victims? Well, in the U.S., the bacterium is typically spread by dog, wood, and long star ticks, as well as deer flies. Contact with animals bitten by the infected ticks and flies is also not uncommon. Francisella can be found in water or soil. Some people catch it from drinking from contaminated sources or breathing bacteria-laden dust. Rarely, cases have been diagnosed in lab workers. As an aside, recently a marine biologist was infected after incurring an accidental cut while investigating a seal carcass. It's the first known case seen in a marine mammal. Tularemia is problematic because of its very infectious nature. It's so highly contagious that only 10 to 25 bacteria, individual bacteria, are needed to cause the disease, entering the human body through the skin, eyes, mouth, or lungs. The incubation period for tularemia, that's the period of time between when you get infected and when you actually get symptoms, that's usually about 3 to 5 days, but it can range from 1 to 14. In most susceptible mammals, the clinical signs include a high fever, chills, lethargy, loss of appetite, fatigue, muscle aches, chest discomfort, cough, severe sore throat, vomiting, diarrhea, and abdominal pain. Yuck. The worst cases are actually life-threatening, and there is a death rate associated with it. The exact symptoms in a particular human depend on where the bacteria originally entered the body, and there are 6 variants. 1. Ulceroglandular. This is the most common form of tularemia. 75% of cases usually occurs following a tick or deer fly bite or after handling an infected animal. A skin ulcer appears at the site where the bacteria enter the body, sort of like syphilis. The ulcer is accompanied by swollen lymph glands, and that's usually in the armpit or groin. Then there's just glandular, also commonly spread by ticks and deer flies. It appears very similar to the ulceroglandular tularemia, but without the ulcer. Then there's oculoglandular. This form occurs when the bacteria enters through the eye. This often happens when a person dresses an infected animal and then touches their eyes. Very bad idea. Symptoms include red irritated eyes with swelling of lymph glands in front of the ear. Moving on, there's the oropharyngeal version. That this variant results from eating or drinking contaminated food or water. Patients may have a sore throat, mouth ulcers, and swelling of lymph glands in the neck. Pneumonic is actually the most severe form of tularemia. It's caused by breathing in bacteria-laden dust, and symptoms include cough, chest pain, and difficulty breathing. It can also occur when other forms of tularemia are left untreated, and the bacteria makes its way to the lungs. And there is also one last form, typhoidal. This form is characterized by any combination of general symptoms without local symptoms such as reddened eyes or ulcers, things like that. In normal times, diagnosis is by blood tests or cultures of the infected site. Now, off the grid, identifying tularemia is more complex, as many of the symptoms are very general. Be suspicious of any possible tick and deer fly bites and any contact with contaminated soil or water in known areas that have tularemia. Handling sick or dead animals is another likely clue that that person may have tularemia. The variants that cause a skin ulcer may be easier to diagnose. Bacteria is treatable with antibiotics, and Francisella tularensis is no exception. Streptomycin, gentamicin, doxycycline, or ciprofloxacin, these are all possibilities for being effective treatments against the disease. You have to remember that all of these drugs have side effects, so they should be studied in more detail. You might consider our antibiotic book, Alton's Antibiotics and Infectious Disease, for more information. We also have the dosages and methods of administration in there as well. How do you prevent it? Well, when hiking, hunting, camping, or working outdoors, it's important to avoid the bites of ticks and deer flies. You want to use EPA-approved insect repellents containing DEET, picaridin, IR-3535, oil of lemon eucalyptus, paramethyldiol, or 2-undecanone. Of course, you should always follow the instructions for each of these products. You should wear long pants, long sleeves, and long socks in areas where there are a lot of ticks and deer flies. You want to keep them off your skin. You want to remove attached ticks promptly with fine-tipped tweezers. In addition, don't drink untreated surface water and stay away from blowing dust in areas where tularemia has been reported. Or use a mask. Closer to home, avoid mowing over dead animals when you're landscaping. Check the area carefully before you do any yard work. And if you hunt and keep rabbits, prairie dogs, muskrats, hamsters, other related animals, you want to use gloves and perhaps masks. Cook any game meat thoroughly before you eat it. Pets like domestic cats are actually very susceptible to tularemia and have been known to transmit the bacteria to humans. At present, however, no evidence of human-to-human transmission exists. There's also no vaccine available to the general public at the present time. Luckily, the death rate from the disease is less than 2%, but the CDC notes that severe variants may raise the level to as high as 24%. Pretty significant. One interesting note is that Francisella bacteria is considered a Tier 1 select agent. That means it's known to be a toxin that has the potential for deliberate misuse against civilian populations leading to mass casualty events. In other words, tularemia bacteria can possibly be used as a biological weapon. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did. For more information on tularemia, visit www.cdc.gov/tularemia.
You know, on the last one there, I think it would make a very poor biological agent. For the type of thing we think about as a biological agent, where the goal of the person using the biological agent is to kill, injure, and maim as many people as possible, because since it doesn't transmit human to human, it wouldn't be a very good agent to spread. That actually could make it a very good strategic biological agent, though, because it could be deployed in a specific area and hit a specific group of people, which if you were, you kind of look at it as like a biological smart agent, in that way. And that would mean that there probably are people out there looking at this bacteria and similar bacteria to weaponize that way. But there's not a lot we can do about that. In the end, the reality here is your risk of this stuff is inherently low, especially if you don't keep rabbits. And if you do keep rabbits and you keep them under the right conditions, it's still incredibly low. I've been doing this show 16 years. When I look at my downloads and all of the file requests for a show, you know, it will be somewhere in the neighborhood of 200,000. Some shows are even more popular than that off the audio over about 48 hours when a show is released. I would say my podcast audience probably has more rabbit keepers in it than just about any large podcast out there. And I've not heard from one person that's ever had this problem. So it's a good thing to be aware of. I'm glad Doc put the segment together, but I also wouldn't alter your life much other than things you should be doing anyway. When you're working with rabbits, you know, washing your hands and things like that. And when you're dealing with rabbits, one of the things, this is not just about infection to worry about, it's injury. Rabbits have incredibly sharp claws, and they're very strong for their size. So I really recommend when working with rabbits, you have your forearms protected in some way that is rabbit-proof, whether that's a leather coat or something like that, or some sort of armor on your arms. I'm telling you right now, and no risk of rabbit fever from them, but that goes equally with handling and working with muscovies. Muscovies have razor blades for claws. I would say they can cut you worse than rabbits in the right situation, especially a drake. A female muscovy will be 5 to 7 pounds, a big one, 7 pounds. A big male muscovy drake, 14, 16 pounds, and I've seen them even bigger than that. They are ridiculously strong, and those claws are ridiculously powerful. So know that if you're working with any of these animals that can injure you, to take appropriate action. Moving on, let's talk about sassafras with Kerry Brown.
Hey, TSP community. Kerry Brown here from Strong Roots Resources, and it's time to talk about sassafras, because it is the time of year to be harvesting and or even transplanting your sassafras trees. Sassafras is one of our natives, deciduous tree that's got a very unique leaf design. I'm going to forget the technical term, but the leaves come in about three different shapes. Some will have a single lobe. Some will have two, we call it the mitten, and often they'll have three. And you'll have all of these varieties all on one tree. This is very common, just one of those kind of interesting quirks of sassafras. All of the sassafras tree has uses, and all of the tree, all components of the tree, contain the compound safrole, which is the essentially the essential fragrant component, I guess is the phrase I'm looking for, that you're accustomed to smelling from actual real root beer, when we're not talking about that artificial stuff. The safrole is going to be most concentrated in the roots, especially this time of year and before the trees begin to bud out and leaf out again. So these are very, very resilient, trees that are accustomed to poor soil conditions. They will most often pop up on sunny forest edges. You're not going to find them, deep under canopy. They're going to want some sun. And it's often the case that they will share a root system, and you'll see groves and groves of them, all anywhere from a couple of feet tall on up to 10 or 12 feet tall, and they've all popped up off of the same root system. So a lot of the time when I am harvesting my sassafras, because I have several of these young groves, when I'm digging them up, I'm coming up with a lot of lateral roots. Now, I have played around with digging these trees this time of year when they're dormant and transplanting them, and I get about a 60 to 75% success rate, even without any kind, there's no taproot. These trees don't develop a taproot until they're much, much bigger and much, much older. There are some cautions worth mentioning about using sassafras. So, ages and ages ago, and this can easily be looked up on your favorite search engine, but there were some studies, some animal studies, done using safrole, using the concentrated component, and large doses were found to have carcinogenic effects on animals. In other words, you probably should not consume concentrated high amounts of safrole, or it may make you ill. That said, I have regularly made root beer and teas and all sorts of things, flavorings from sassafras root, with no issues to my liver. So that's just something to kind of take under consideration. Take under consideration what else, what other kind of stresses your liver and the rest of your filtration organs may be undergoing, but just something to be aware of. Like I was saying, all parts of the sassafras tree have uses. So you can get that safrole from the roots, from the branches, especially the young green wood, and it's not as concentrated in the leaves. And actually, what the leaves are traditionally used for, once they are dried and powdered, is as a fillet, as a way of thickening your soups and your gumbos in the traditional Cajun style. These trees have brilliant fall color. They go from a yellow to an orange to a red. They're stunning, and really, they're probably one of my favorite trees that we have out here. They will get up to 60 feet tall. So we have some that are mature, that have been here longer than I've been around. And then I have several little groves where they're actually so thick that I get in there regularly and dig out trees to transplant, to sell, to give away, trade, and all that good stuff. Because if they're too clustered, they'll begin to suffer. So eventually I am letting some of these groves that are just on the downhill side of my food forest be reduced down to a few trees to act as an eventual overstory tree. So there's a little bit of a 101 on sassafras for you. I am preparing my class schedule for the spring. That's going to include pasture management classes, foraging classes, kind of a permaculture 101, pollinator garden design, and several other offerings. Best way to know about that is to get on the mailing list at strongrootsresources@gmail.com. You can just send me an email over there and I can add you to it manually. Or if you go to strongrootsresources.com, you should get a pop-up request. So thank you guys so much for listening and for reaching out to me. If I can help you in any of your foraging or property development endeavors, give me a shout, and we'll talk to you next time.
You know, you guys should definitely check out what Carrie's doing here with his classes and things like that. The more you can learn about this stuff, the better off you're going to be. Anyway, I will throw one thing into this. The type of leaf that the sassafras tree has, and there's actually a lot of trees that have this leaf type in Asia. It is called polymorphic. It's exactly what it sounds like, polymultiple morphic, right? So there's another word for it. It's like heterophyllous or something like that, but polymorphic is the more generally accepted term. Anyway, let's move on now, and let's hear from... who are we going to hear from next? I'm lost here. We're going to hear about auditing our pantry from Nicole Sauce.
Howdy, TSP. Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Holler Roast Coffee. And I have a question for you. Are you snowed in or are you about to be snowed in? It is winter time, and we have shorter days, longer nights, and it's a great time to focus in on getting things done that we don't make time for when we're really busy in the summer running around after our animals, growing our vegetables, preserving vegetables, all of those things that happen in the summer. And one great indoor winter project that you can dive into is a pantry audit. Now, I know that doesn't sound sexy. It's not like building your seed growing shelves or anything fun like that. But this is something that can give you the foundation to be way more stable if you do it right. Now, we listen to the Survival Podcast and we store what we use and use what we store. That's the philosophy behind having a functional pantry. And life is a journey. It's not a destination. Because of that, what often happens in pantries is we start out storing a bunch of stuff, you know, when we first get into it, that's just durable, dry stuff we don't necessarily use. And then we start storing what we use and using what we store on a rotation. And then life happens, right? Changes come up. Your kids grow up and want to eat different things. Or maybe they leave the house and you don't need to store as much to have a cushion as you would when you had more mouths to feed. Illness can lead to lifestyle changes, and then you're eating differently. You may just be redefining what's healthy and embracing the ketovore lifestyle or the carnivore lifestyle and realize that your pantry is filled with flour and pancake mix and cereals and dry rice and barley and oats and I don't even know what not, a bunch of commercially produced crap that has seed oils in it. And there's no room to put the good stuff away. Is this you? If you're home more and can cook more, your pantry's going to look different than if you're at work all day and barely have time to bang out a meal before it's time to do it all again the next day. Your pantry should be a reflection of your life. So this time of year is a great time to dive in to your pantry audit. And there are, of course, three steps to doing this because, you know, my three things, three steps, three things you can keep track of. And the first one is to take a moment. This is something you can do over a delicious cup of Hollow Roast coffee and reflect and document how your life has changed since the last time you did a real good look at your pantry. If it's been 5 years, that's fine. If it was last year, that's fine. Just think about, am I eating and using the same sorts of supplies as I was in the last year? And be honest. If you have had that can of sauerkraut kicking around for 10 years and never used it, you're probably never going to use it. And I bring that up as the example because I had a can of sauerkraut that I got in college that I moved probably 6 times before I admitted to myself I was never going to eat it. And think about all the energy I put into moving and storing and space that it took up where I could have been storing things that were useful to me. So be honest with yourself about what has changed and what has not changed and what you want to have on hand to serve as your food and supplies savings account, and what's just in the way of you being able to keep track of everything and use your pantry as a system that supports your future prosperity. Now, once you have that, pull out the key things that you know you're going to want to change about your pantry, and then you'll have an idea of what you want to keep when you find it and what is no longer serving you and should go away. The second step is to take on one area. You just go then at this point, right? You take on one area of your pantry at a time. And I mean, if you store most of your stuff in kitchen cabinets, commit to one cabinet, commit to getting it all done, and do that on a regular schedule rather than trying to take on all the areas. Personally, because I use the power pantry method, I have short-term storage, which is more the things that I'm using day-to-day, and then I have a longer-term storage for the backlog or the food and supply savings account that I can pull from to bring into short-term storage. So when I take this on, I'll start by categories. I'll go through canned goods in 2 places, and then I'll go through my short-term storage, 1 cabinet at a time in my kitchen and my laundry room. And then I will go through the long-term storage, which is in the prepper pantry. That's how I attack it. I'll just take one of those on a Saturday a week for a month, and usually by the end of it, I'm super happy. Add to that the freezers, though. If you are a carnivore eater, the freezer audit is pretty important because you may have things in your freezer that are taking up space. After 2020, I had changed my eating so much that I no longer needed to store wheat berries, which I did. I was grinding my flour, making homemade bread, all of that stuff, and then I stopped eating bread. And I now store a little bit of wheat berries in case I want to thicken a gravy with it, or my mom's in town, or I want to serve bread. But other than that, I really don't need it. And so the 100 pounds of of wheat berries that I had are now no longer serving me, but they sure do take up a lot of space. You're going to run into things like that as you take on one area at a time, which is why I recommend just do one area at a time, get it all worked out. And by finished, I mean it's been organized, you have the pile of things you need to get rid of, and you get rid of the things so that you know what's there. What I find really helpful to do during this time is have a pile of keep in store, use up soon, because often I'll find things that, you know, got moved around and they're going to get near their expiration date, so we may as well build it into the supply use plan and the meal plan. And then this no longer serves me. This no longer serves me. I give you permission today to throw away if you can't give it away, because you're just, otherwise it just ends up being an acre around your neck that keeps you from moving forward in many other ways than just your pantry management. And then the third step is to be ready to take next steps. And the next steps are to reorder, which means to resupply. Recycle, which means get rid of the things that you can get rid of, and if you can use them for compost or something else, more is the better. And rejuvenate. Turn it into a cycle rather than an annual thing, and you'll find that things stay together a little bit better over time. So just like you should be active in managing your finances, managing a well-run pantry takes some attention, it takes a decent system, decisions, and honesty with yourself and your family. It also takes maintenance so that it can serve its highest function, to be your supply and food savings account in case something goes wrong, or even if it doesn't, because what happens when you have the power pantry method in place is you find out that when the next ice storm's coming, you're not worried at all because you're like, eh, we've got it. We've got what we need here. We're good to go. If you want to learn more about me, check out my website, NicoleSauce.com. And don't forget to get the best premium coffee you can get your hands on at HollowRoast.com. Make it a great week.
So as I was saying, right in this same vein I mentioned during the intro, is freezer audits, especially when you own more than one deep freezer, and especially when you have chest freezers. What we do with our chest freezer is we literally take everything out. We don't even just like look and go, okay, that's there, because you lose shit in a chest freezer. And then we look at it and go, do we give this away? Do we eat it? What have you? And it's been around a while. It goes on the top and it goes on the schedule for dinner. Because what will happen is you end up with some things like, oh, that's really cool. And then you don't eat it because, like, I want to save it for later or whatever. And then I'll be out of it when it's gone. And then more stuff comes in. And the next thing you know, it's on the bottom. And it never sees a light of day again. And 3 years later, you find it, you know, freezer burnt at the very bottom, stuck to the bottom of the metal part of the floor of the deep freezer. Don't do that. Another thing I'll give you as a tip. I cut out in our chest freezer for the very bottom a piece of thin plywood that fits perfectly on the floor. And then, you know, chest freezers a lot of times have kind of a little shelf off to the side with this housing the compressor. And so there's like two levels of bottom, and I cut one for that too. And I set them at the bottom there. And what that does is prevent exactly what I said, is you get some condensation and buildup and all. It prevents you from ending up with something literally frozen to the floor. It will almost always come off the wood, but it may not come off without damage off the metal on the bottom. And then you are in a position where the only thing you can really do to fix it is to completely defrost it, which you should probably do that once in a while too. But in the end, you know, it's a simple little hack, and I definitely encourage you to do what Nicole said and do what I said. Audit the freezers, audit the pantry, and like you said, be honest with yourself about what you're not going to use. Either go ahead and use it. If it's something that can go to dogs, feed it to dogs, give it to people, chuck it out if you need to, compost it, whatever. But make sure you're not occupying space with things that are never going to get used. All right, with that, let's go ahead and hear about solar pumping of water with direct solar and some really cool applications here from Ryan Steva, who's also known as the Homestead Consultant. consultant. He's going to mention a bunch of products. There's 12 of them that I actually have links for in the show notes. And when he's done, I'm going to come back and I'm going to give you a little hack for one of the issues he points out. There's an alternative. It's very simple that will work in most, maybe not all situations, and some thoughts about using some of this stuff more as a backup than a primary.
Hey, TSP community, this is Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today I wanted to talk about direct solar water pumping systems. Now that solar has become so inexpensive and the components are so inexpensive, it actually makes a lot of sense to start using solar in remote locations on your property rather than trying to take grid power out to those locations. Direct solar water pumping has a lot of advantages both in simplicity and in cost. So I'm going to go through some use cases that I've thought of to help get the ball rolling for people thinking about how they can use these direct solar systems on their own property. The first use case is pond aeration. So if you've got a small pond, a Miyagi pond, something like that, you can use a small direct DC water pump to pump water up and out into the air, and then it will fall back down and create an aeration effect. And this will work anytime the sun is shining, so you can really help keep your ponds aerated. You could heat a pool or pond, so there are these solar heaters that if you pump water through them, they will help heat up the water in those systems, especially during cold portions of the year. Those can be run with a small pump and a solar panel directly connected. You could get water for your animals from a remote location. Let's say there's a stream or a spring or a pond on your property, and you want to move water to your animals, and those pond or spring or stream are much closer than any other water source. Well, you can take a small DC pump, stick it in the water, and put your solar panel out until those systems are full. And so then you don't have to lug water from one place to another. Another potential use case is flow-through wicking beds. If you have a rainwater collection nearby or a spring or some other water system nearby, and you don't want to use city water or you don't have access to it in the location these beds are, you could use a direct solar water pump to fill up those beds. And if they're flow through, you can basically just keep it flowing through back into the collection system. You might have a small pool or a small tank just slightly downhill from your flow through wicking beds, and now you can pump water up to those wicking beds and then allow it to overflow back down into the water catchment system that you might have off of a building or from some other system. Another great opportunity is to store energy uphill. So when the sun is shining, you can pump water through a pipe uphill to a tank and actually store the energy in that tank. So it's like having a water battery uphill that will run even when there's no solar and no other power because it's stored higher up on the landscape. Now, there's a couple of subtleties and things that are worth considering with this. How do you deal with the water if you can't shut the pump off? Because oftentimes these systems are far enough apart that a float switch is not viable to shut off the pump. So a couple of options are you can overflow that tank into a pond. A good example is I had a client who had a spring on the bottom part of their property. They wanted a pond in the middle part of their property, and they wanted a water storage tank at the very top of their property. So what we did was we put a water catchment system at the spring, put a pump in that system, pumped water all the way up to the tank, and then the overflow line from the tank went to the pond. So it kept the pond essentially spring-fed anytime the sun was shining and anytime the tank was topped off. Another option that's really cool is if you put a float valve inside the tank, you can have the water shut off going to the tank once it's full, and you can use a adjustable pressure relief valve on the line going into the tank. So once the pressure hits a certain level because the float valve has closed, that overflow valve, you can hook it up to a line, and that line can run to whatever you want it to. So it could run to a pond or to some other system or even another tank to fill that tank up before you use the overflow to go somewhere else. Finally, I want to talk a little bit about pump options because this can be kind of a tough area. The ones that I have come across that I've liked the most are as follows. There is a very small brushless DC 12-volt pump that I really like. It's submersible, and you can hook it right to a 12-volt panel. They seem to last forever because with the brushless system, they don't have brushes to go bad when the voltage drops, so they actually are perfect for hooking directly to a panel without a controller. They're very small. If they burn out, they're really inexpensive, but I've never had one burn out yet, and I've been using them for over a year now. The next type of pump is a submersible 12 to 24 volt pump. These are going to need a linear current booster, and those can be submersible and can actually be used as well pumps. So that what I was talking about with pumping up water to a tank uphill could be done with these directly with a linear current booster in line to make sure that it turns on and off when the panels get enough power to be able to power the pump. And then finally, the last pump that I'm aware of that I really like is a Gunfoss SQ Flex. There's several in this lineup. Some of them take a controller box. Some of them have essentially all the controller smarts inside the pump. They're very expensive, $1,000 plus, but many of them can pump over 600 feet. And they can take a wide range of voltages and amperages to run the pumps, and they have controllers that can control based on what it's receiving. It just ramps up or ramps down the flow of the water based on that. So those are some options for direct solar water pumping. I'm sure there's a whole bunch more. If you have any questions about this topic or other creative homesteading solutions, send your questions into Jack and he will get them to me. I'll make sure to answer them as quickly as I can.
So here's my two add-ons. One, remember when he's talking about, like, you've got this water source, whether it's a pond or a creek or spring or whatever, and you're throwing water with this pump whenever the sun comes up on a direct solar to a tank somewhere or something like that. And the reason that you might not want to use a float valve at the delivery end is because you can't also say to the pump, stop. Right, this is basically an on-off. It's a binary situation. Enough light hits the panel, the pump starts running, the sun goes down, the pump stops. There's a way to handle this without a sophisticated pressure relief valve or something like that, or without redirecting the water out at the delivery side. And it's really simple, and I use this all the time in my aquatic systems to reduce the full pressure on the other end or delivery on the other delivery side. For things like timer-based ebb and flow beds, I do this, is one example. My primary pumps that run, that just simply aerate ponds, I always have this done to them as well, and I see no reason it wouldn't work here. What I do is right when you come off the pump, before you keep heading toward wherever you're delivering that pressure on the other end, I install a T. And then off of that T, a short P, and I usually use PVC for this, but there's other, you know, hosing and valves you can use. It's up to you what you use. Off that T, a little short piece of valve, and then I put an inline valve. A simple, like if it's in 1 inch, it's a 1 inch valve. If it's half inch, it's a half inch valve. Whatever it is, I'm talking about slip on the PVC, and it's an on-off valve, a straight valve, okay? And then off of that, maybe another little piece of PVC and an elbow so that you're not spraying it where you don't want it. And then you're just pitching it back where it came from. And that's more oxygen in that system if that benefits you. If it's a spring or something, it doesn't really matter, okay? And then you go to the side where you're delivering when that pump is running. In this case, you'd want to do it when the pump's running at kind of its full peak when the sun's up. And you make sure it's delivering water for you. You go back over to where that swing valve is you put in. You start tightening that valve, or you start opening that valve, right, until you get it to where it's bleeding off some of the pressure, but you're still getting delivery sufficient to what you want on the other end. If you do that, and then you put in just a plain Jane float valve on the delivery side, when that float valve is tripped and it cuts off the water delivery, it's simply going to take the surplus pressure and push it through that straight valve. Now, depending on how much pressure we're talking about, what we're doing here, I try to dry fit as much as I possibly can, but in this situation, you may want at least up to the valve, glue that assembly, because you don't want that blowing out on you and stop delivering water, especially if it's something important on the other end, that it stay full. But by doing this, now all you need is a float valve, which any delivery side system that can overflow and you don't want it to should have a float valve on it anyway. The actual cost of parts beyond the float valve is about $6-7. You're talking about an elbow or two, maybe a straight coupler or two, and some scrap pipe, and the valve will be the most expensive. And like a 1-inch straight valve is going to cost you between $5 and $7. And it is something that maybe once in a while, depending on the source of the water, you want to go open it all the way, and then you want to pinch it back down to where your set is. And you kind of want to, what I usually do is wherever I have a set on a valve, I mark it, and I mark it with like a soldering iron or something, because the Sharpie's going to wear off. And that way, you go when you open it, you let it flow and clean itself out, and you go right back to that mark. The other thing I would advise, and I advise this always, when you're sending water somewhere in that delivery near the pump where you can access it all from one place, put a shutoff valve there too. So that if you're servicing something on the other end, you can just shut it off. And I don't care if it's plumbed to a well. I don't care if it's plumbed to city water. It's a pump in a reservoir, whatever it is. Always add that. The more shutoff valves you have in your system, the more you can isolate things when you have maintenance that needs to be done. And trust me, the happier you will be when something inevitably is broken or busted, because it's going to happen. A dog will jump up in the air, 6 foot in the air like a fox on a documentary trying to get a mouse, and he'll land on this assembly that you put all this work into, and water will blow up in the air. Ask me how I know. All right, so that's my little hack, my little add-on there. The other thing I'll say is I had no idea that I could buy two direct drive DC pumps for like $11 and a solar panel that would run them for like $30. I didn't realize it had gotten that stinking cheap. So those would make, for those of you that are doing like garden ponds, Miyagi ponds, all stuff like that, not really a great primary aeration system, but a great backup. So sun comes up, they go on. Sun goes down, they go off. Increase it a little bit. Throw in a simple charge controller. Throw in a deep cycle battery. And you can, the world is your oyster on how you want to run that, because we could be running a secondary pump on AC that doesn't even get run on a timer, except when we're at a power outage. So now we're doing direct drive during the day. We're storing the surplus energy. We're getting through the night. We don't need to run generators back there to keep that stuff alive, because losing, some like 25, 30-inch catfish to a pump going out sucks. Again, ask me how I know. All right, now, I want to talk to you guys a little bit about not selling Bitcoin again like I did last week. Be a little bit softer, gentler version of Jack, and realize that last week my enthusiasm was directed at the people telling you what you need to do with your money, not you doing what you need to do with your money. See, I don't believe that's my place to tell you what to do. All I can do is advise you and tell you what I do, and then you're a grown-ass man or woman. You do what you want. So when I said don't be spending your Bitcoin, because I got a couple emails that said things like, if I'm not going to do that, what's the point? Well, the point right now, one of the things you need to understand is what we would call the adoption arc, right? We are in the very early stages of the adoption arc. Let's say that you had bought something like Google stock or Amazon stock very early on, and it 10x, 20x at that point, but we're still in the point, people ain't even figured out what the internet is yet, but you had the confidence that you had winners in Amazon and Google while the dot-com bomb boom was raging with all these companies that didn't do anything. Your financial advisor might be like, yeah, let's sell this and we'll harvest 5 years worth of gains, but how much better off would you have been if you recognized where you are in the adoption arc and said, no, fuck that, I'm not selling this shit. This is long-term money. To me, the Bitcoin that we're stacking, okay, not all the Bitcoin that we ever touch in any way ever, but the Bitcoin that we're stacking, the Bitcoin that we're self-custody, this is our future. This is money that we look at as never money until never's not never anymore. And again, I gave you multiple examples. So when people say that I'm saying not to spend it at all under any circumstances, you couldn't have actually listened. You just heard what you didn't wanted and completed the blanks for yourself to prop up your whatever your bias is. I gave examples of like, well, when would I sell some Bitcoin to buy a house if I was 30 years old? And the fact that I said that means that never is not what I said. But once you put it away, once it's part of your stack, it should be the last thing you spend because it's the most long-term valuable asset you can hold. So everything else should come before you dip into that well. Now, for some people, like I said, you maybe want to buy a house. Maybe you've been doing this a while. Maybe you got $500,000 worth of Bitcoin. The person in that situation that sells $50,000 to harvest a down payment, finances the house, and now can get a mortgage that makes sense for them, I'm not going to shit on that person for doing that. The person that says, you know, once a month I throw 10 bucks into my Lightning wallets and I zap people on Noster or something like that. I zapped while you were listening to this show. Well, while I was producing this show, I listened to all the segments. I don't just get the expert segment, throw it in there, and say the hell with it. I listen. That's how I can comment and make sure that something's not wrong with it or something. So I listen while I'm put together. I zapped four people on Noster while I was doing this show. I'm listening and I'm looking to post some multitasking. So obviously, I'll do it too. I've said if I go somewhere and they take Bitcoin, I love that. I whip out my Strike app and I pay them with dollars, but they get Bitcoin. But I also said something that's true, whether you understand it or not. Unless you're buying from like Luigi's Taco Shop or something like that. If you're buying from a major company, they don't want Bitcoin. They might take it to get because they think it's some more business or something. I call it orange washing. They're flipping it on the backside. They're not putting it into a reserve. There's no major companies out there that are doing Bitcoin reserves with their surplus capital that are obtaining that Bitcoin from Bitcoin you spend. In other words, when you use something like Strike Bill Pay or whatever, and you're paying your electric bill in Bitcoin, you're not doing what you think you're doing. You're just sending dollars and you're selling Bitcoin to pay the electric company in dollars. That's what's really happening. They're not actually getting Bitcoin. They're getting USD that's being converted on the back end and deposited into their working capital as plain old fiat dollars. All you've done is created tax consequences for yourself. So if we can get into a state like El Salvador's in, where there's all types of places all over the place, and they've got little QR codes there, and we're taking Bitcoin, we can have a new discussion about it. But we don't have that. That's not where America is. And since the majority of my people that listen to the show are in America, you deal with Bitcoin as it is, you deal with vendors as they are, and you deal with tax law as it is, I will speak to that as my primary. I'll acknowledge other people exist, but that's not my. I'm not going to give the advice to 99% of people that only applies to 1% of people. That's just dumb, and I'm not going to do it. And my big issue with all of these people running around shooting their mouth off, all of these influencers, most of them who have bought their way or traded with PR companies their way into being an influencer, okay, they haven't done it organically, is they're only saying shit to be paid attention to, and they're telling you what you need to do with your most valuable asset. I tell them to shove their opinion up their ass. If you want to end up, after you've evaluated everything, coming to the same conclusion, I don't hold that against you, but don't do it because they said so. And this preposterous notion that unless everybody signs up for bill pay through Strike or Swan or River and uses Bitcoin to pay their electric bill and their cell phone bill and their cable bill and for their streaming service that Bitcoin can't succeed is literally the dumbest argument I've ever heard as to why you should spend your money the way they tell you to. So again, if you want to live that way, God bless you, but please understand what you're doing. The only gain for you in this, because there's no gain for Bitcoin in this at all. I'm sorry, there isn't. And no one will ever be able to explain to me with math why I'm wrong at this point in the adoption arc. So just go away. It's not 2010. We're not buying pizzas for Pizza Day here. Okay? That world has changed. It's evolved. It's a different place. You will not make Bitcoin more successful by using Strike Bill Pay to pay your electric bill. what you are trying to do with this is to keep as much of your money in Bitcoin as possible, as frequently as possible, and you're hoping that Bitcoin's propensity to grow in value will, you will end up, let's say at the end of 3 or 4 years, with more sats than you had had otherwise. I'm telling you, you probably won't. It is a much easier, look at the people who are 100% committed to this. Look at their model and follow that model. So what is the most committed person to this that I have ever, and I mean ever, under any circumstances seen, is Michael Saylor. The bro is buying billions of dollars of Bitcoin weekly. Yes, and technically what they're doing is printing money through their stock to do it, but this is a full-on 100% commitment. Every Monday there's an announcement that on Sunday we bought another dumb billion dollars worth of Bitcoin. Is Michael Saylor's MicroStrategy accepting Bitcoin as a form of payment? The answer is no. Does that make him less committed? No, all he's saying is, I don't want the accounting nightmare. If you listen to him, instead of try to find a reason to hate him, because some people want to, because he's not a full retard maxi. He's a maxi, not a full retard maxi. He understands that even though there is no number, there is no second best, some people think there is, and they're going to go do it. If it's good for crypto, it's good for Bitcoin. Just like I told you, so that's where he's coming from. And what he said, and this is absolutely the fact, every piece of accounting software in the modern world is built for the dollar, not for Bitcoin. Everything in the tax code for a business advantages you to leverage debt and take fiat, not to take Bitcoin. But the dollar is fundamentally flawed. It is being eroded by inflation. There is no plan to change that. So holding your surplus capital in dollars is economic suicide for a business and or a person today. So the formula is sweep the excess capital into Bitcoin. That's it. And like I said last week, the reason that so many people who have Bitcoin podcasts and all don't want to say it that way is then what else is there for them to say that week? Unless something happened that legitimately matters, you know, not raging against a crypto EO that's beneficial to you because you didn't get exactly what you want, like a full-on autistic retard, unless you have something legit, what are you going to talk about? So they invent a lot of things to talk about out of necessity to fill airspace. And I'm sorry if you don't like it. I'm sorry if that bludgeons the nose of your favorite Bitcoin influencer. And there's plenty of these people that say this that, overall, I really love them. They're just not right about what you need to do because they don't know who you are. Does that make sense? I'm not telling you what to do or what not to do. I'm telling you the landscape. Now you make your own decision. But I'm not going to fabricate bullshit and guilt you into doing something that most of these people aren't doing themselves, by the way. Most of these people aren't doing it. I just saw a post today about how everybody needs a solo mine. That's playing a lottery. If you're going to get into mining, there are mining pools that literally just pay you a fixed rate at any given time. That rate changes, but they pay you a rate for your hash power because the pool's big enough that they're going to win enough blocks that they know X amount of hash is worth Y amount of money, Y minus Z equals the payout. So you can then factor into your spending, your investing, your electricity usage, all of that, a known quantity and know your ROI. That's an investment. And you may not know your ROI in dollars because Bitcoin goes up and down, but you know your ROI in sats and you know the long-term trend and you can make a very informed decision about your mining. When you solo mine, you are buying a lottery ticket and you're buying that lottery ticket every day with the energy usage on that miner. I'm sorry. I don't care if you don't like it. Well, this one guy, he had like a $400 miner. That's what started all this. And he found a whole block, and he got $100,000. Yeah, and some asshole yesterday went into a convenience store and bought a scratcher ticket for $20, scratched it off, and won $1 million in Texas. It happened. I looked it up. Does that mean you're going to go out and buy a lottery ticket every day? Some of you are. Just know what you're... See, that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying not to solo mine. I'm saying don't let some influencer's X post or post on Noster or YouTube video change what you're going to do because they said to do it. Know why you believe what you believe, and then know why you're doing what you're doing, and then do what you want. And if somebody thinks that means I'm saying if you spend any Bitcoin ever, you're stupid, that person is too stupid to talk to other people. Okay? I hope that makes sense. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and wrap things up. Again, I want to remind you, TikTok, TikTok, spring is coming at you like a freight train. We've got some great products for item of the day this week for you guys to get ready for that. We've got the Barina plant starting lights. We have the 2-inch nursery pots, which are very, very cost effective, and you will get at least two or three seasons out of them, if not more. And then we've got the Vivor raised garden beds all for you this week. And again, start thinking about fertility for your plants as well. I'm a big believer in some people think you should give your starts very little fertility and make them work for it. I want to spoil them. I want them not just to have all the fertility they need. I want them to have all the biology. I want to inoculate my starts with mycorrhizal fungi. I want to inoculate them with beneficial bacteria because a baby plant that is born into scarcity, it triggers their epigenetics. Okay, epigenetics are genes that activate based on environment rather than like genes that are going to determine that you're going to be born with blue eyes. You're going to be born with blue eyes. Your eyes are not going to turn to brown over time unless you're full of shit. That's an old army joke, okay? But you're going to be born with blue eyes. But there are certain things that, based on the way you eat, that will trigger certain genetic traits above the base code. And a plant that is born into an environment where it does not have abundant biology to interact with will literally epigenetically adapt itself to scarcity, meaning that when you give it that biology later, it will either not utilize it or it will not utilize it to its full ability because it never expected to find it because it was denied its association on germination. The first thing your plants want to associate with when they germinate is mycorrhizal fungi. And for most of you, the best way to get that is to buy an inoculum. I have it on the website. I'll add it to today's show notes, even though it's not officially an item of the day this week. But it's a very good product. It lasts a long time. I'm just advising you, when you use it, plant your seeds. And when they just begin to germinate, that's when to go ahead, poke a hole and add it. Because that mycorrhizal fungi, once it activates by temperature and moisture, it only has so long before it can find that association, before it itself will die or at least weaken. All right, with that, we have wrapped up another week of new content. Tomorrow will be a Friday flashback, and then next week we'll do it all over again. Make it a great weekend. Get those raised beds going. Get those plants started. Audit that pantry. Audit that deep freezer. Make something productive happen this weekend. And again, I'll catch you Monday with a new episode.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.